Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. Rachel Jusler will be here to highlight this Saturday's Food Fest. We'll learn about the upcoming Juno Symphony Wildlife Cruise. Laura Zahasky will be here with a preview of this weekend's Music on the Mountain Festival at the Tram. Andy Klein will be here to highlight a new brew from the Alaskan Brewing Company, and we'll find out about a special screening of An Inconvenient Sequel at Goldtown Theater. Looking at the forecast, widespread rain showers likely through Sunday, decreasing to just a chance of rain Sunday night and Monday. Then Tuesday through Wednesday, also just a chance of rain. Back to rain likely next Wednesday. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Reducing the boundaries of the newly created Bears Ears National Monument in Utah would amount to the federal government going back on its promise to protect the culturally important area. That's the reaction from tribal officials, environmental groups, and others following a recommendation Thursday by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The recommendations are still secret, besides a two-page summary, but several news organizations who spoke to people in the Trump administration say Zinke is proposing to shrink the boundaries of Bears Ears and at least two other national monuments established by Presidents Obama and Clinton. Julia Bernal with the Pueblo Action Alliance spoke at a press conference organized by U.S. Democratic Senator Martin Heinrich of New Mexico. Bernal says changing the boundaries now would go against the months of discussions and public hearings that led to the monument designation in December of last year.
It was promised to the indigenous people that our existence, our lands, are important to this nation. It is our government's responsibility to keep these promises and not take them back again. How many more broken promises are we going to have to endure?
Utah's congressional delegation and local officials were among those who opposed the monument, calling it an overreach of federal authority. Monument opponents say they want to reserve the right to utilize the land for grazing, mining, and other development. President Trump has referred to the Bears Ears designation as a land grab. A coalition of tribes, along with environmental groups, urged President Obama to establish national monument protections in order to protect cultural and sacred sites throughout some 2 million acres in southeastern Utah. In the public summary that referenced the report to President Trump, Secretary Zinke said the monument declarations resulted from what he called a well-orchestrated campaign by monument supporters. An Oklahoma tribe has hired a lobbyist in its efforts to open a casino across the border in Missouri. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch reports the Osage Nation this month hired a former speaker of the Missouri House to lobby on the tribe's behalf. The tribe in December contributed more than $50,000 to Missouri Governor Eric Greitens' inauguration, which Osage Nation Chief Jeffrey Standing Bear said was meant to establish a good relationship. A 1988 federal law allows tribes, in some cases, to establish casinos outside their reservations, if the land in question is within the tribe's historical territory. In this case, it would require Governor Greitens' approval. A dress code at a Texas school district is gaining nationwide attention after a 4-year-old Native American boy was sent home for having long hair. CW39.com reports Jabez Oates went to 2 days of pre-K before Barbers Hill Independent School District said he couldn't come back until his shoulder-length hair was cut. In a Change.org petition, his mother Jessica Oates says her family is Kokopa Indian and that her son loves his hair, which is considered a sign of strength. Oates provided documentation to the district to get Jabez excused from the dress code for cultural reasons, but the principal refused. A non-Native author who many say falsely claims Native American heritage is up for a national literary award. John Smeltzer's young adult novel, called Stealing Indians, is nominated for a 2017 Penn Literary Prize. The Seattle Alt-Weekly The Stranger reports novelist Sherman Alexie said, quote, Smeltzer has been held in great suspicion and contempt in the Native world for 25 years, end quote, and that Smeltzer has long relied on dubious claims. Those include lying about having a PhD from Oxford to get a university job. According to The Stranger, Smeltzer's adoptive father wrote to an Alaska newspaper in the 1990s to clarify that his Caucasian son was not Native. The Native village of Taslina in Alaska does count Smeltzer among its enrolled members. The Penn Center says it is aware of the concerns over Smeltzer's nomination and will investigate further. With National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, Lori Scandling. And as always, Jeff Brown, our producer, is on the board. And thanks to him for making the show happen. This afternoon, my first guests are Rachel Jusler. She is with the Juno Arts and Humanities Counselor. Counselor. Sometimes it is.
It is not, Rachel? It kind of feels like a counselor. Yeah,
it provides good therapy to our community, including tomorrow when the 10th Annual Food Fest is happening. And we have a couple of vendors here with us, too. But, Rachel, why don't we begin with
This is going to be very exciting for our 10th Annual. This year, we actually have a lot more producers, just local producers that are happening. We have a huge amount of forage goods. We have all kinds of seafood and produce that's just never ending. We have a little bit of design, different things. And this year, I actually have some music to finish off the whole show. Plus the normal workshops. We have workshops going on all day that will be in the gallery. And we can go through some of those if you'd like.
Why don't we talk about the location? The location is the Jack itself.
It is at the Jack, and it's at the Jack in the front yard and in the center and in the backyard. We've got vendors surrounding the whole building. It is going to be from tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the morning will be the kickoff, and it goes until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it's a more daytime event. And then I do have the music that will be playing just from 1 to 2. So it will just be finishing off the event.
And who are the artists who would be playing?
These are going to be the Huckleberry Pickers.
How appropriate.
Yes, completely.
Had they had a different name, they could not have been
No. And that's why they called me and said, hey, you know, that we play like American-style music with lots of working the land type themes.
Perfect.
And I was like, okay, bring it on. And it sounds like they're actually going to be doing this as a warm-up set before they go and play a gig later that evening.
Up at the mountain.
Yeah, up at the mountain, yeah. So
what are the workshops? I did see some of them, and why don't you say what they are
the
and
workshops,
what times
and
in
we
case
will have
those
them at,
folks are planning.
Every hour on hour starting at 9:30 was the easiest way to do it.
Okay.
At 9:30, we have Pickling 101 with Sarah Lewis. She works at the Cooperative Extension. At 10:30, we have foraging with Corrine Conlin, who's been doing these foraging workshops for the last few years. And she has a really nice presentation that goes on. At 11:30, we'll be Canning 101, also with Sarah. At 12:30, we've got our new one, the home composting. So we do have the composting. Lisa will be in. She will have a booth. She's also going to bring me a separating station for the Jack, which I'm super excited about. And then she will be giving a workshop at 12:30. And then at 1:30, we've got a workshop on primroses by Ed Byarski is what he's doing this year. So it's going to be a full-on. Those will be in the gallery. There's no need to sign up for anything like that. Once you get into the workshop, you'll have a little, if you need more information, sign up sheet.
Is there a charge to visit the food
fair? There is no charge
all
for this
free.
Whatsoever. This is a free public market.
Very fun. And as you said, 10th annual. So
10th
this is
annual.
One of the most robust this, list of participants.
Well,
I've
and
seen.
Then and that's so in the past, in the last 10 years, you know, we have not had as many growers in town.
Right.
We have not had the really big one this year is seaweed. Seaweed mm-hmm. and forage products from the sea. I've got we've got a barnacle that will be showing up and they have their kelp salsas. I've got Tidalwood Food and Forage and he does some seaweed work. I've got Alaska Coastal Seaweed and they do their own seaweed harvesting. So we've got them. I've got Fun Guy Forage Products. He's back from Haines. He's going to be up with his berry pickers and his mushrooms. We've got Marms and Meeks. They do some vegetable type stuff. I've got a lot of Orsi. Orsi has three big tables. He's going to be selling a whole bunch of stuff. We've got some artwork by Stephen Evans. We've got Raven Lunatic that does some ravens. Juno Green sells living basil. Harbor Tea and Spice will be there. It's a new show downtown, or the place downtown.
Shop downtown. Mm-hmm.
Salt and Soil will be there, represented with the Southeast Watershed Coalition, USDA for Natural Resources. Then I have a whole garden row that is Douglas Community Garden, the UAF Cooperative Extension Service. I've got Juno Compost, Juno Community Garden, and Edits Edibles, all in your garden row. I've got, we'll have a stage with a bunch of information for the new Jack going on there. So, because this will probably be the last one in the Jack, because it will be knocked down eventually. And then in 2020, we'll have a really wonderful festival outside in the new building. But at
well,
that point,
some of the entrepreneurs who are here, and I think that's very exciting. We have two entrepreneurs here, Carly Moeller with Mo Fish and Kylie Ray with Panhandle Products. Carly, talk about Mo
Panhandle
Fish.
Panhandle Produce.
Produce. I should have
They've got lots
and
lots of vegetables.
Carly, talk about Mo Fish, what it is, and how you got into this business.
Well, thank you for having us here. First off, it's a family business. So my dad bought a boat, and we decided to gillnet. And it's 11 years now that I've been gillnetting with my dad. And my brother and little brother are out there as well. So it's a family business. We sell fish. Sockeye salmon is kind of our hit. We love our sockeye salmon. And then we also have spot prawns that we'll be selling at the market.
Oh, well, so exciting.
We'll take orders because the shrimp is open October 1st. So we don't have any right now. But
all fresh, all Southeast Alaska. Yeah.
They're frozen fresh.
Sure.
Right.
When did you start gillnetting?
11 years ago.
How old?
13 years old.
So yep. You are a 24-year-old entrepreneur on behalf of Mo Fish.
Yeah.
That's exciting. We were chatting a little bit before the show how wonderful it is Juno is seeing the next generation, being, I think, forward-thinking in using our natural resources. So, Carly, Mo Fish also includes, as you said, shellfish. So you see primarily orders for then sockeye and for the spot prawns, which begin October 1st.
Correct.
Have you ever done this part of the business, which is
No.
the marketing and selling?
No. So this is our first year actually doing the marketing, and I'm doing it, not making my
right
dad
now.
suffer through that. So it's new, and I'm very new at it, but I'm so excited. I absolutely love it.
I can haul nets in, and I can convince people to buy what's in the nets.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Kylie. So, Kylie, yeah. Panhandle Produce.
Yeah.
What all is involved on the market shelves for Panhandle Produce?
Oh, man. So anything and everything we can grow. And this year in particular, it's been, as you know, a very wet, very dark summer. So some of the products that we have this year, it'll be things that have thrived in this weather. So we've got four different types of cucumbers. I've got these really interesting lemon cucumbers, which are almost the size of like a softball at this point. Very interesting look, but they taste very familiar, like you would recognize that cucumber taste. Let's see, I've got a lot of leafy greens that'll be available tomorrow. I've got tons of pickles. Of course, when you say products, we actually do have a lot of value-added products, and that became something we did to minimize our overhead, being in the farmer's market circuit. You just never know how much is the right amount to harvest. So if you end up with a lot of leftover, that's how we got into the pickling. And now that's kind of taken on a whole life of its own. So we'll have all kinds of pickles. Additionally, we've got the peppers and jalapenos, which have been doing really well this year. Go figure.
You learned that kind of dispersed light and a lot of moisture.
And I must say, I do have to vouch for the pickles.
Thank you.
I've been eating them a lot.
Kylie, is this your business?
My husband and mine, yes. Uh-huh. And he's the Farmer Eli. Last year, we kind of went by Farmer Eli's Panhandle Produce. And we've been a couple team this year. So I'm definitely kind of bringing more of the value-added stuff to our table this year. And we are actually this is a transitional year for us anyway, because we're making that jump from a hobby-sized grower doing just the farmers markets to actually opening a year-round location, which because of that Kickstarter that we did about this time in about April, I think it was, which was successfully funded. So we were really, really lucky to be able to actually pursue that. So we're kind of in transition right now. But we're looking at doing an indoor hydroponic farm so that we've got consistent supplies of leafy greens. And that's something that you're starting to see a little bit more, I think, in the Juneau area. But, I mean, you really just the more the better in this context.
And where do you envision opening the retail side of it then?
Kind of in the middle of town, and on the way to Costco, in fact. And so it'll be, we envision that being partly a growing space and partly a retail outlet, so that both the seasonal organics that we grow, as well as other products, you know, for instance, the Orsi's or Ed's Edibles or something in that vein, could also be available at our venue.
This seems to be a real explosion here in Juneau, just kind of a microcosm
This
recognition of foraging natural foods, foods of the region.
Well, Matt, I know that Darren over at the UAF Cooperative Extension Service is very concerned about food security, and living in an island economy or ecology, we definitely need to be worried about that.
The less food that has to come by airplane
or
on barge.
Yep.
The more fortunate we are.
Absolutely.
What made you decide that this could be a living in a climate that's not very forgiving?
Oh, man. Well, it started out as my husband, you know, finding his work with Glacier Garden. So he got that commercial nursery experience, really hands-on working with plants, and realized that that's something he was very passionate about. And it initially was just a hobby business, and that's kind of what we've been doing since about 2013, just traveling all the markets around town. And this year's been also an explosion of venues for producers in town. There's not necessarily maybe more producers, but just that many more places to find local produce, like the Salt and Soil Marketplace, which has been really great. And some new growers, maybe even home growers, have a great venue there. But I think what we realized, or what kind of clicked for us along the way, was that, you know, this is the type of thing that, you know, if more people are doing it, there's no need for it to be a competition of sorts, because there is more demand than there is supply.
Yeah. The market is definitely there.
Absolutely. So we want to bring everyone else in that's thinking about doing this kind of thing, and we want to encourage that so that there's another generation of agriculture here in Juneau and in Southeast.
And did you grow up in Southeast?
I did. I'm a Juneau girl.
So the next generation. And Carly, is this the first time your family has gone retail? Meaning, have they sold through brokers in the past?
We've delivered to Trident Seafoods forever.
So this is
a huge new step.
This is a leap.
Yeah.
Yeah, the family retailing then.
Yeah, so I was going to school and I had my, you know, mind on something else. And then I came back and I realized that, you know, this is a beautiful thing to be able to use my hands to create, you know, a product that people can consume that's like perfect. I mean, we make a perfect, where we, you know, provide a perfect
healthy
product.
Fresh and loads of protein.
Yeah. And so I'm just really passionate about health and all that in general, and so it just fit. And I realized that, you know, we've been doing this specialized pressure bleeding, it's called, where you flush water through your salmon to, you know, it helps
makes
with tests.
It totally takes the blood.
It's way really, really good.
It's very high quality salmon is what she's talking about.
Yeah. Well, we're talking with Rachel Jusler of the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council about tomorrow's 10th annual food fest. It begins at 9 o'clock and runs until 2 at the Jack, including outdoor sites. Free workshops every hour begin at 9:30. And again, they also are free. They'll be in the gallery at the Jack. And we've been chatting with two young entrepreneurs, Carly Moeller of MoFrish and Kylie Ray of Panhandle Produce. There'll be two amongst a lot of vendors there
tomorrow. And I didn't get through the whole list of vendors, but I do have the whole list listed online at jahc.org.
Well, this is exciting, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 25th of August, 2017. It was on this day in 1718 French immigrants founded the city of New Orleans, named for Philippe II, the Duke of Orleans. The French had claimed the territory in 1682, and they sent a starter population of prisoners, slaves, and bonded servants arriving in New Orleans to find a swamp with a lot of mosquitoes surrounded by hostile Indians prone to hurricanes. The French then sent 90 female convicts straight from the Paris jails, chaperoned by a group of nuns until they could be married off to the men who were waiting there for them. Two engineers laid out plans for the original walled village, which then came to be called the French Quarter. It became an American city in 1803. It's the birthday of the novelist Brian Moore, born Belfast, 1921, a man who Graham Greene once called my favorite living author. He said each book of his is dangerous, unpredictable, and amusing. Brian Moore, one of nine children born into a devout Catholic family, quickly rejected Catholicism as he grew up, but continued writing about it for most of the rest of his life. He was a newspaper man for a while and then took up writing novels. His first one came out in 1955, The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn. He moved to New York and in 1966 moved to California, where he remained for the rest of his life, wrote more novels, wrote screenplays as well, including the screenplay for the Alfred Hitchcock movie Torn Curtain. Brian Moore, who, when he died in 1999, his obituary in the paper began, "The most accomplished and least fashionable writer in Los Angeles, died last week." It's the birthday of the poet Charles Wright, born Pickwick Dam, Tennessee, 1935. His father was a civil engineer for the Tennessee Valley Authority. He was a bookish kid in high school, read all of William Faulkner by the time he graduated, served 4 years in the U.S. Army, stationed in Italy, where he discovered the cantos of Ezra Pound, and he began writing poetry. Charles Wright, who said, "Without language, there is no poetry. Without poetry, there's just talk. Talk is cheap and proves nothing. Poetry is dear and difficult to come by, but it poles us across the river and puts music in our ears." Here's a poem by Ron Kirchy, "Noon or the Siesta." On one of my mother's last outings, we drove to the Art Museum in St. Louis. I could feel her falling away. Slowly, we moved across the slick floors, the Bronco Buster in one room, the Passion of Christ in another. It was all the same. I was about to lead us out. When we came to the Van Gogh, a couple asleep, his shoes beside the sickles. Mom said, "They're not going to get good silage loafing around like that." On the way home, we crossed the Mississippi, a metropolis dissolved. There were fields beyond the waterworks, a Delft blue sky, and bales of hay with tired men sitting and smoking. "Noon or the Siesta," a poem by Ron Kirchy from Vampire Planet, published by Red Hen Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Juneau People for Peace and Justice, Congregation Sukkot Shalom, and several other community groups will be hosting a Solidarity with Charlottesville rally at Marine Park on Sunday, August 27th from 2 to 3:30 p.m. to honor the sacrifice of those who have worked to eradicate hate, violence, and the systems reinforcing both. Rally organizers invite the community to join them in a commitment to the principle that all people, regardless of race or religion, are created equal. This message brought to you by the Juneau People for Peace and Justice.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling. My guest is Sarah McNear Grove. She is president of the Juno Symphony, and we're visiting about one of the fundraisers the symphony hosts in order to support this organization. This is the annual wildlife cruise, and it's not this Saturday. It's a week from Saturday, and that's September 2nd. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for joining us
today. Thank you for having me.
Talk about the details of the cruise, what time, when people should show up, what will happen. I assume one or two whales will be waving at you, but if there are other activities on board.
Okay. I can't guarantee the whales, but I can guarantee that you will have a good time anyway. We have a quartet, a string quartet that's going to play live music, and the players are some of our student symphony players, as well as a Juno Symphony member. So you're really going to enjoy having some live music on this cruise. We'll have hors d'oeuvres to eat, and there will be wine tasting provided by Specialty Imports. So it's going to be a wonderful afternoon. It is next Saturday, September 7th, and board at 1:30 p.m. The cruise goes from 2 p.m. We'll return you back to the harbor at 5 p.m., and that is at the Donstatter Public Boat Harbor in Auk Bay.
So. What other fundraisers does the symphony do? It is one of the many arts nonprofits in our community, and I know that as they do, the symphony has to fundraise. What else should people be putting on their calendar?
Okay. We traditionally, in addition to the wildlife cruise, have done a raffle and a silent auction, and we're changing things up just a little bit this year to kind of put some new blood into us and put a fresh face on things. We are going to have an outcry auction, and it's going to be near our Pops concert, which is usually the beginning of June. And our Pops concert this year is the music of James Bond. So we're carrying that over into the auction event and kind of have a James Bond theme. So if you like dressing up and want to dress up in your James Bond best clothes, get them ready. And this will be on May 25th. So kind of put that in your calendars and think about attending that auction. The other thing that we do is a raffle, and we will be doing that this year. Again, traditionally we have held the drawing at the June concert, but because we're doing the auction, then we're going to move it up, and the drawing will be at the April concert. So we still have our same events. They're just going to be a little bit different and new, and we hope people will participate in them.
So, of course, the Juno Symphony, and folks may not know this, pays for a professional conductor.
Yes.
And Troy Quinn is that individual. But you also pay for a full-time manager. And I understand there's a transition in that position right now.
That's right. Our executive director has recently decided to move on to other things in her life. And so we are currently looking for an executive director who would like to kind of head up. So if anybody is out there thinking that you'd like to support the Juno Symphony, here's one opportunity for you.
And it is a paid position.
Yes.
I would guess you'd need good organizational skills because the symphony has quite a calendar. And the season's about to start, right?
The season, we're really getting ready for our season. Our first concert will be towards the end of October, October 21st and 22nd. And we have four main stage concerts throughout the year, October being the first one and our Pops concert in June being the last one, as well as a symphony showcase, which is smaller groups, ensembles of symphony players that like to do smaller works rather than the full symphony. So we have five concert events throughout the year.
That seems like a very robust performance schedule in a very small town. Are we unusual to have a symphony for the size of our community?
I don't know if we're unusual to have a symphony for the size of our community, but I think we are unusual in that we're rather isolated. And so to have the quality of players that we have in this town to be in the symphony, I think that's unusual.
How many individuals play in the symphony typically?
Yeah, it varies, you know, depending on the size of the piece and the needs. But I would say anywhere from 40 to 60 players would be a typical size orchestra.
And is there an instrument that you need more of or that is not represented in case you have folks listening today who, have an interest, aren't quite sure, might be new to town?
Violins, just mainly because that's the most plentiful instrument in an orchestra. So if you play a violin and think you would like to try out, give us a call and we'll put you in touch with our music director and you'll have a little audition with you. It's not threatening, just kind of get a feel for whether you can play and fit in with what we do. But, you know, if anybody out there, if you think you're interested, give us a call and we'll talk it over with them.
We're talking with Sarah McNear Grove. She is the president of the Juno Symphony, and she plays the clarinet in the symphony as well. We're talking about the annual Wildlife Cruise, which is one of the fundraisers for the symphony. It is set for next Saturday, a week from tomorrow, on September 2nd. You should be at Stater Harbor at 1:30, and the cost is what, Sarah?
The cost is $75, and you can get your tickets at Hearthside Books or at the Jack, and we have a link to the ticket sales through the Juno Symphony website as well.
And it sounds like music and food are part of the excursion.
It's going to be great. You're going to have a wonderful time. I can't, as I said, I can't guarantee the whales, but you'll probably see something.
And I understand those tickets sell out.
They do, so you don't want to wait. If you want to go out and have a good, wonderful way to end the summer, start the fall, and support the Juno Symphony, we'd love to see you on board.
Food and music on the water. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
This is Bird Note.
Have inspired music from the sublime to the ridiculous, from classical compositions to garage bands. Can you name this bird-inspired melody? How about this enduring rock anthem? Did you ever dance the Funky Chicken? And what is the name of this rock and roll wonder, rivaled only by Louie Louie in the inscrutability of its lyrics?
I wait, everybody's heard about the bird.
Special thanks to Judy Collins, Leonard Skinner, and the Trashmen for their appearance in today's show. Oh, and Stravinsky, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
That's a hard song to follow. That's just kind of engaging. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's about 32 minutes past the hour. I'm Lori Scandling. My guest with me is Laura Zahasky. She is with the Zahasky Family Band. They will be one of about a dozen performing groups that will be participating in Music on the Mountain. And that will be happening tomorrow night, that Saturday, between 5 and 10 up the tram. How does that work, Laura? You buy a ticket and it's good for everything? Or talk about the cost and the logistics there.
Yeah, the price is $15. $15 gets you up the mountain and into all of the performances. We're going to have two stages, one in the restaurant, one in the theater. Both will be running from 5 to 10 p.m. And we actually have 14 bands this year.
That's an amazing deal, really. So yeah. Ride up the tram and 15 bands.
Yeah,
for $15.
Pretty much.
Now, I was asking you, knowing of the Zahasky Family Band, if it was still together and where they've been.
Yeah, well, we changed the name from Zahasky Family Band just because we had an uprising as siblings. We're like, nope, not it. So we have actually been under the name the Alaska String Band for about 10 years now. We've been touring. We've toured Australia, New Zealand, some in Canada, across the U.S. several times. We made a CD recently and also a film that's been broadcasting on PBS. We've had about 76 million viewers in the last year, and it's slotted on PBS to be aired the next 2 years as well. So we've been very busy with music, having a lot of fun, and we're very excited about the festival this weekend because not only do we get to play, but we get to play along some of Juno's finest musicians.
Let's talk about who else will be performing at Music on the Mountain on Saturday evening.
Yeah, we have 14 great groups. We will be playing Juno Soul, Club Baby Seal, which is a group of stand-up comedians. It's the first time the festival will have something of that nature. North Country Cajun Club, Michael Truax, Empty Oil Barrier Band, Full Circle Music, Flustered Cluckers, The Huckleberries, Annie Bartholomew, Lonely Winter, Rebecca Friedlander, who is actually from San Diego, California, Alyssa Fisher, and SJ and the Dragon Flyers.
So you mentioned the sibling disagreement resulted in the Alaska String Band name. It seems to have been successful. Have the siblings all stayed together?
We have, yeah. We are all still playing, and my brother actually married 3 years ago, and his wife Emily has been playing for the last 3 years with us as well.
How many members are in the band?
Six.
And where's your next foray then?
We will be here this fall. We're going to do a short Christmas tour, hopefully in the state. We're working on a few tours at the moment. Not sure quite where those are going to lead, but we also want to record a CD this spring as well.
So the Mountain Music Festival has happened for several years. And do the proceeds go to the performers, or is there a special entity which receives the proceeds?
No, actually, the performers are going to have a CD table, so I would recommend locals come out, support your performers by purchasing their merchandise. There will be a CD table set up where they can do that. The tram has a very reduced rate tonight, so the tram in and of itself will not be making a huge amount of money, but they want to do it to support the community and as a great PR event to support the local artists.
Yeah, they've done this almost every year. So
yeah,
really,
it's about
exposure of the music and the opportunity for the groups to sell some of their music on CD.
Yeah, and a wonderful venue. So
Laura, you've spent the last couple of years touring. Talk a little bit about what that means to be on the road.
It means missing Juno's Winters, which is a wonderful,
opportunity.
Wonderful day. About January or February is a great time to head to Hawaii, head to Australia, head, you know, Seattle, anywhere south of there. But so that's been great. We actually tour in a 40-foot bus and have toured coast to coast about three or four times.
Wait, how many of you are in the 40-foot bus?
Six of us. It's a bonding experience.
I would guess that it would have to be.
Yep, and this weekend will also be a bonding experience. That many musicians in one place at the tram is going to be very hectic. We're very excited about it.
Now, having two performance venues, is this new, having the two sites?
This is new. In the past, it's been Jim Duncan, the manager, has been working with my dad, Paul, and Elva Bontrager to put the event on. And my dad has stepped more into running sound technician. So this year, Elva and I have been working, and we wanted to expand what the festival has been. In the past, it's been, you know, probably five or six bands in the theater. It's been a great experience, but we just wanted to see if we could maybe broaden that and bring in some different genres a little bit for everybody. So having the two venues, we're very excited about broadening the spectrum of music that we can then have.
We're talking with Laura Zahasky of the Alaska String Band, and Music on the Mountain happens this Saturday. It's a heck of a deal. $15 gets you up the tram and down the tram. And you can see and listen to 14 different groups perform, including some comedy for the first time. There will be two different venues at the facility at the top of the mountain, and it begins at 5 o'clock. Anything else people should know about Music on the Mountain this year?
The restaurant is going to have some great dinner specials as well, so come hungry. There will be lots of great food as well.
So make an evening of it. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thank you, Lori. Have a good night.
Thank you.
and glad to have you aboard on a Juno afternoon. My next guest is Gretchen Wild, and she is with an organization called 350 Juno. And please first tell us what that is, and then we'll talk about the movie showing that the organization is sponsoring.
Okay. Glad to be here.
Gretchen Kaiser, I should say.
It is Kaiser, but, you know, I do go by Wild sometimes. 350 Juno is a new organization we started this spring, and its goal is promotion of education, public policy advocacy directed at climate action. It's citizens banding together to make changes. Primarily, the focus, it's a local chapter of a worldwide organization, 350.org, which has about 400 chapters around the world. And where you get that 350 is, not to get too scientific, but basically it's the level of CO2 we can have in the atmosphere and be safe.
Is that like parts per billion?
Million.
Per million.
And right now we're over 400. So the goal of the worldwide organization is to reduce the emissions of the greenhouse gases that are trapping the heat and causing the climate change in the world.
Talk about the special showing that 350 Juno is sponsoring here in Juno of the new movie from Al Gore called An Inconvenient Sequel.
Right. Starting tonight through next Thursday, Gross Alaska Theater out at the Glacier Cinema is showing this new movie, as Lori mentioned, Inconvenient Sequel, subtitled Truth to Power. It's 10 years since the original movie, An Inconvenient Truth, that talked about global warming and climate change. And this one is new. It gives us 10 years update. It talks about the science, what the climate science is telling us. It gives us some of the bad news, but then it segues into the good news. There is a lot of progress going on in the world to address the climate disruption we're seeing, like today coming into the Gulf Coast of Texas. And then at the end, it talks about what we all can do and what we must do. It has a very inspiring ending. I saw it this past week in D.C., and by the end of the movie, you just want to kind of get up and start working. A central message of the movie is that communities can take action, and individuals in those communities can work with their neighbors, their local government, and make a difference. So in that sense, I think it's timely in Juno. We've had some recent discussions on energy at our local assembly, and there's a draft energy strategy in the wings, probably coming to the assembly from the Juno Sustainability Committee, the city's committee, in the next month or so. And the idea for our local group, which does promote education, is to, you know, we're thinking about it and go, you know, let's make this a show that young people can see. And so the idea then is that on next Tuesday, on the 29th, the 7:10 showing for all middle school and high school students, if you show up with an ID, you can get into the movie for free. It's free intermission for the Juno School kids.
So that's 7:10 next Tuesday, August 29th at the Glacier Cinema. I think everybody knows where that is. For the general public, the movie is playing out there the 25th, which is this evening, through the 31st of August. And it does indicate on here bargain night tickets for others. The free showing on Tuesday is first come, first serve, and the doors open at 6:30. What are you hoping a high school or middle school student will come away with? What is the key information that you hope will?
Well, that they could make a difference. I guess that it is real. Climate change is very real. The science is not debatable at this point. And I think they can learn from that. And once in the title, it talks about truth to power. So the truth is learning what is the truth about climate change, and hopefully they'll learn something at the movie, and then how they can be empowered to going forward in their schooling, in their community, in their own family life, in making a difference. We're all in this together. We're all on the planet. There's no other place we're going to move to. So, and the focus on younger people is that, you know, our generation, Laura, you and my generation, you know, can do what we can, but a lot of the tough work is going to fall to the people of this age.
They'll be inheriting whatever we leave behind. We're talking with Gretchen Kaiser of 350 Juno. Gretchen, our assembly has had some recent conversations about the Paris Climate Accord. What has that come to conclusion?
At our local level? Well, they passed a resolution. There was a resolution put forward by Maria Glaucheski. And it was approved this past week, and it focused more on the steps that Juno has taken to date and sort of a reaffirmation of Juno as a city government and a community to do what we can to reduce our fossil fuel emissions.
And as you said, the city does and has had for a long time a sustainability committee that is part of our city government.
Right. So at the resolution, an earlier version of that had a statement committing Juno to a climate mayor's network who... U.S. cities, 360 U.S. cities that have committed to do what they can to reduce their CO2, their carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas emissions. And some of the assembly members were not ready to sign on to that type of national or U.S. city group, so that portion was removed from the resolution. What I have read recently on this issue is that the work underway in U.S. cities and businesses and individuals is and just market forces underway is that the U.S. will likely meet what it had agreed to at the Paris Agreement, although the country now has been taken out of that agreement. So notwithstanding what's going on in Washington, D.C., U.S. citizens and businesses and communities are moving forward. And we're making progress.
So folks who would like to know more about how climate is changing and why are invited to go see an inconvenient sequel, Truth to Power. It is running at the Glacier Cinema beginning this evening through the 31st. And the group 350 Juno is sponsoring a free night. That would be next Tuesday, August 29th at the 7:10 p.m. showing for middle and high school students who show up with an ID. Gretchen, one last thing. Does 350 Juno have a website, or can you refer us to a website with more information about this organization, 350?
Well, the parent organization, you can just Google 350.org.
And it'll pop up.
And it'll pop up immediately. We don't have a website at this point. We're still kind of working on things. We do have a Facebook page, just 350 Juno, and it'll pop up. People may have seen 350 Juno in the 4th of July parade. There was a parade of species group, and that was Juno 350. And then, of course, some of the members have testified on climate issues recently with the assembly, and now we're doing this movie showing. So you'll hear more about us.
Thank you for sharing the information and your work. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's about 8 minutes before the hour. I'm going to start this segment with a sound.
How about this sound?
Okay. I have to say, being a volunteer here has many benefits, but this is one that I've yet to experience. I'd like to welcome Andy Klein. He is with the Alaskan Brewery Company, and Marcos Morehouse. He is a roaster with Heritage Coffee. And Blake Haas, you've been here before.
That's
you
right.
are a brewer at Alaskan. And we're doing a tasting right now of Heritage Coffee Brown. And what's in it?
Well, it's a pretty cool beer, Lori, because it's a coffee beer, and coffee beers are beers that are out there. This passes over to Jeff on the board there. He's doing the hard work here.
He is. He has to listen to me hour after hour.
So there's a lot of coffee beers out there, and typically they're stouts, porters, things like that, kind of have, you know, darker, malty beers.
This is just delicious
This
smelling.
Is a beer that's built on a brown ale, so it's a very light kind of beer, but it has coffee, distilled coffee added to it. And it also uses these really interesting, this really interesting process where we actually, and you see in this bag, we actually roasted
with the
malt with the beans, and Marcos headed that up. So that's kind of an interesting process, right?
Marcos, how did you know exactly how to do that? You know how to roast coffee beans of various roasts and flavor. Mm-hmm. What about with the
this was a
malt
little
in there?
Process because it's really light. It's could you know it's flammable. It was.
That's important.
It was a little bit scary at first, but we figured it out. We just, you know, heated it up temperature and cut the flame off, so that eliminated the fire risk and got it roasting. And then we turned the flame back on and just kind of finished the product that way till we thought it was good. The Alaskan Brewing was there, and we were tasting it as it was coming out. And
Blake, did you help coordinate the process with Marcos then?
I did not, no. I just drink the beer.
and he's coordinating the event that's happening tonight.
Let's
so
talk
that's
about
the big
that.
Thing. Yeah.
When and where is that, Blake?
So that's going to be out at the brewery there in Lemon Creek, and it's going to be from 5 to 7 tonight. So what we're going to have there is we're going to have free samples. Whoever comes in can get a free sample of Coffee Brown. Our Mocha Milk Stout, which is our new pilot series, equally as delicious.
Look at that beautiful thing with the muskox on it.
Did you finish the first sample, Lori?
Because
we got the second one coming up here, right here.
Yeah, so we'll have those two beers on tap. Also, I'm going to infuse one of our IPAs with some of the coffee, the whole coffee beans that went into making the Coffee Brown. So we'll
Andy is pouring Mocha Milk IPA, and it is
milk. It's a stout, not an IPA.
Yeah, oh, pardon me, a stout. It is a beautiful, beautiful color, and I have to say, the Heritage Brown is amazingly light for having the coffee in it. And I was sharing with Andy, I found it at this tiny, out of the way store this weekend, last weekend on the coast of Washington, and we bought a 6-pack and enjoyed it. So the event tonight is at 5, did you say?
5 to 7, yeah.
At the tasting room?
Correct.
Great. Yeah. Is it free?
Yeah, it's free to come on
wow.
in. You'll get samples of all the beer that we have there. Heritage is going to swing by there, and they're going to have some hot coffee, some cold coffee for us, too. Mm-hmm. The same coffee that went into the beers.
So get to taste the ingredients in the beer and then taste the beers themselves. And the Mocha Milk Stout's a fun
oh,
one because it
word.
Is a mocha.
That is delicious.
It has cocoa nibs in it as well as a Guatemalan
Huehuetenango.
Oh, wait, what is that, Marco? I feel like I should be doing the tango after.
The region of where the coffee came from.
Say that again,
Huehuetenango.
Is that Central America?
Guatemala.
Yes,
Guatemala. Huehuetenango.
It's quite the word.
Okay, it's a beautiful word,
yeah.
And it's sounding prettier by the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I am not a beer aficionado, but this is delicious. I could actually see mixing the stout here, the Mocha Milk Stout, with, I don't know, maybe some milk.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I mean,
for breakfast? I don't know.
Beer floats are really good with a little bit of ice cream, that kind of thing. The Mocha Milk Stout is pretty amazing in that application as well. Yeah, pretty good.
Yes. How often do you offer these kind of free tastings? They're not too frequent, are they, Blake?
Just about any time we release a new beer. So if we're going to release a new seasonal, new pilot series, we'll try to do something like this so people can get a chance to get in there, try it out.
A few times a year, but you're right, not that often.
We
like, you know, especially in the summer, it's a busy time of year for us out there. So it's a lot for the staff to also have an event because we're dealing with, you know, busloads of people coming through all day as well.
Sure, of course. Now, these are special brews, both of them, the Heritage Coffee Brown and the Mocha Milk Stout. Will they only be available for a short period of time, meaning grab it now?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the Heritage Coffee Brown's our seasonal beer. It's available in 6-packs and other packages as well. But it's going to be kind of leaving in the November time frame. You know, between now and November is the time to get it. And the same with the Mocha Milk Stout. So it's the same schedule. Be available kind of through October, but might be leaving the shelves even before that. As you see winter ale come on the shelves, you'll see the Heritage Coffee, you know, going off.
These
so that's how that goes.
These are two beautiful beers. If you're interested in trying each of these, Heritage Coffee Brown and the Mocha Milk Stout, drop by the Lemon Creek Alaskan Brewing Company tasting room today at 5. Have a chance to interact with the staff as well as from those from Heritage Coffee. Thanks to all of you. This was one of the more fun interviews, mostly because you're wonderful company, but also I'll just say goodbye and take another swing. Thanks for joining us on a Juno Afternoon. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, everyone.